The organization Dam Concerned Citizens hosted 4 lectures at SUNY Cobleskill, with one on October 21, 2015, being John Vickers' report on reconstruction activities at the Gilboa Reservoir. This audio recording was made at that presentation and was also the basis of an article in the winter 2015 issue of the Gilboa Historical Society Quarterly. Most of the art referred to in this talk can also be seen in that article. Copyright, See in a Circle, 2015. Gilboa Historical Society and John Vickers. This is John Vickers' talk.
Harry Reservoir, and so I'm going to kind of try to take it to, you know, the modern side of the times, 21st century improvements that we've made to Gilboa Dam. So thanks for allowing me to be here tonight and speak with you. Okay, so I'm going to go through the dam reconstruction and improvements that we've made, spend a little time about dam flood, Gilboa Dam, and how it provides some flood mitigation. And then where we're going from here. And then we'll have some time for questions and answers, hopefully, at the end. So here's a recent aerial photograph of Gilboa Dam. In the background is Schoharie Reservoir. That's to the south. And in the foreground is the Schoharie Creek below Gilboa Dam. And to the left is the east. And Gilboa Dam is a combination of a concrete gravity dam, and that's the majority of the dam that you see there in the photograph, this area right here. And that concrete gravity section also serves as the spillway control section. But it also consists of a shorter segment of embankment dam as well. I'm just going to talk about quickly some of the features here, because we'll talk about them in a little bit more detail during the actual reconstruction. So we've got the spillway control section. This is the spillway. These are the spillway steps. This here, where we've got actually water passing through the notch when this photograph was taken. This area right here, 220-foot long area, is the notch. And water passes over the spillway and into the side channel floor, which is sloped from east to west, down into the plunge pool, and then from there it goes down the Schoharie Creek. The concrete section is 1,324 feet long, and the embankment section is 709 feet long. The maximum section is 182 feet high, and that occurs right in this area right here. The other components here in this photograph, this is the laydown area where the contractor set up all his equipment and supplies and staff and a concrete batch plant on site to do the reconstruction work. And you may be able to see in the background a boom which stretches across the reservoir. It's a debris boom that was also installed several years ago to help facilitate the work. So here's a graphic that I think is very useful in explaining why we did the construction, the reconstruction effort, and what we did. So this is a cross-section of the spillway control section. And within this diagram, you've got the reservoir. Here on the left, that's the southern end, and this is the northern end. These are the spillway steps. This dashed line here represents the old dam where some of the stone facing had been lost due to weather and erosion over the years. And part of the reason why that occurred is because the spillway faces north, and water would get behind those bluestone rocks, which were each very sizable. However, water would get behind them and freeze and dislodge them, and then when spills would occur, it would pop those off and carry them downstream. That lost a lot of weight from the dam. And this concrete gravity section works based on its weight. Its massive weight is what is resisting the force of the water, which is trying to push it, either push it over or slide it downstream. So, a quick history lesson, recent history. Back in the late 90s, DEP commissioned a consultant to go around and look at all the dams and do a stability analysis on those dams. And out of that stability analysis, we found that Gilboa Dam had a marginal factor of safety against sliding for storms not much larger than the storm of record, which at the time was the January 1996 flood event. So the city took an emergency action, and through that emergency action was able to do emergency contracting and install 80 anchors. This is a diagram here of the orientation of these anchors. Some of them went down through the top, and then and others were at an angle. And the purpose of those anchors was to pin the dam to the bedrock below and provide additional weight to resist those forces and prevent the dam from sliding downstream. That was part of the emergency work. And then the city went through a deliberate design and construction program to rehabilitate the dam from top to bottom. And in that process, they used computer and physical models. And I actually got a chance to go out to Utah State University's Water Resources Lab, where they built a full-scale model of the dam, as well as some scale models of cross-sections of the spillway, to figure out what's going to be the new stair-step design. We found that the old stair steps were very large, and water would tend to jump and miss steps. And the purpose of those steps is to dissipate the energy of the water as it tumbles down. So we came up with a new design, a graduated step system starting out 3 foot by 3 foot to 6 foot by 6 foot to 12 foot by 12 foot. And that allows the water to better remain in contact with those steps and tumble down. So that's one improvement. The other improvement was that in order to fit all those steps into this new design, we added a lot more concrete and a lot more weight to the dam than it had before. So these post-tensioned anchors provide about 65,000 tons of additional weight. And the net additional concrete that we placed onto the dam added another 100,000 tons of weight to the dam. And now the dam meets modern dam safety criteria. Another improvement included the creation of an inspection gallery that works its way all the way through the dam, the concrete gravity section. And within that gallery are 129 drains that were drilled into the bedrock below at various depths. And the purpose of those drains is to relieve water pressure that builds up underneath the dam and wants to lift the dam up. And so water now can relieve itself through those drains and into the gallery, and then there's a trough inside the gallery that collects all that water and discharges it down in the plunge pool. It's another improvement over the original dam. And the last one on this slide is the side channel floor. The previous side channel floor was not anchored to the bedrock below. The new one is. Here's a photograph of those post-tension anchors back in 2006 being installed through the top of the spillway crest. And these had 58 strands of steel. And the way it works is you drill a hole through the dam and into the bedrock below, and then you place these steel cables down into that hole, and then you basically place concrete into the bottom where the bedrock is, and that forms an anchor. Then you pull up on those steel cables, and now that steel is in tension and is wanting to provide a downward force, and you clamp it off at the top, and now you've got that additional 65,000 tons of weight pushing down on top of the top of the steel. Also in this photograph is a picture of the old siphon. There were four siphons that were constructed as part of the emergency work to try to divert water through the dam site and allow the work to continue on all the anchoring. The spillway notch, which I talked about earlier, was another feature that enabled the diversion of water to enable construction of all these post-tension anchors. So the reconstruction effort, that was all the emergency work. We'll talk a little bit now about the deliberate work. The project was broken up into five phases. We broke it up into a phase design construction so that as we would complete design on a certain phase of the project, we could immediately contract and go into construction while the rest of the phases of the dam reconstruction project were designed. At this point, we're about halfway through the whole process. The first phase included installation of crest gates into that notch that I talked to you about. And I'll tell you a little bit more about what those crest gates, how they operate. And that was completed in 2012. There was a construction contract, and its whole focus was just to prepare the site for the next contract. You had to remove a lot of trees, stabilize the ground, put in soil erosion and stormwater controls, and build a temporary bridge so that we could keep a lot of traffic off of the State Route 990B just off the property, and build some access roads. And then we actually got into the reconstruction of the dam, which was completed this past summer. We had substantial completion. We actually completed all the concrete work a little over a year ago. The next portion of phase three is the construction of a new low-level outlet. Diane mentioned, I think, that the previous dam had some issues. One of the issues was that the low-level outlet over the course of its 80-plus year history leading up to the emergency condition was not always maintained as it should have been. And so some of the low-level outlet intake was basically impacted by sediment over the years, and we couldn't use it anymore. So now we're putting in a new one. It's a 9-foot diameter tunnel, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. That contract was awarded to a Texas firm, Southland Renda, and they've already started putting together their submittals and getting ready to do some work. The fourth phase is the rehabilitation of the Shanika Tunnel intake chamber. And we're at 90% design on that phase, and we expect to complete that rehabilitation in 2020. And then once the low-level outlet is completed also in 2020, then we'll have a contract come in at the end to restore the site to a more natural state. So here's a photo from July 2007, and in this photo you can see those big steps, and you can see also this lighter colored area where the stone is missing, and the darker areas where there still is the bluestone present. So it lost a lot of stone. Here's those four siphons, the four temporary siphons. Here's the notch that was cut into the top. I'm going to show you some slides of the actual reconstruction effort. These are not in any particular order, but they help to illustrate some of the work that was done. Well, one of the things that we found after Hurricane Irene was that we still needed to have siphons. And so we replaced the old ones with two larger siphons that carried the same amount of water as the four previously did. But they were built to stay in place for a good 10 years so that it would be there until we got the low-level outlet completed. And here you can see the construction workers working on the spillway steps, and they're near the top at this point, And this is just over the plunge pool area. And these are the crest gates behind them. Here's a close-up view of that work. And here's the crest gates. There's a 220-foot-long notch. And the crest gates consist of stainless steel panels. Each one is 20 foot long. And there's 11 of them. And there's a bladder, an air bladder, underneath these curved crest gates. When they're down, they cover up that air bladder. And as you pump air into the air bladder, it pushes the gates up. And so that's how those crest gates work. So you can see the air bladders are here. And here are the steel gates. And then these straps here are so that you don't push too much air into the gates and push the gates over. So those are the restraining straps to keep them from moving. And the top of these crest gates, when they're fully raised, is at the same elevation as the rest of the solar crest. This is looking down into the plunge pool below the top of the crest. And here they're working on the concrete floor in the plunge pool. And you know, there's a lot of massive cranes. Kind of gives you an idea of the size of this dam. This is what we call the West Training Wall. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But all the masonry of the dam is being repointed. And the contractor for this contract completed about 90% of that repointing effort. And the last amount will be completed by the contractor that's doing the low-level outlet. During the process, you know, we had to be able to move water as it would spill naturally over the spillway, and so they built a temporary diversion wall. So in this case, they're working on this side, and if water was to spill, it would go down along the other side. This is a photograph of the side channel floor and the concrete, and it was placed in a hopscotch pattern, and this is the two-way steel reinforcement present in each one of those concrete slabs. They're 24 foot by 24 foot, and there was four anchors in each one of those slabs which pinned that slab to the bedrock below. Here's a view from the eastern end. You can see the side channel floor and you know, some of the side channel floor being worked on at that time. At that point, you know, we're still a little bit early in the project. You can see that we were spilling at the time through the notch. Here's work on the west training wall. Gives you an idea of the height of that wall. Found that we wanted to improve the stability of that wall. So just like we installed post-tension anchors into the spillway crest, they did the same as the west training wall. The exterior is that bluestone, but behind it is concrete. And so they drilled through the concrete into the bedrock and installed those anchors in the same kind of manner. Here's a close-up view of some of those anchors having been installed. And here you can see those strands, and this is the locking device after it's already been tensioned. In addition to anchoring the concrete mass of the west training wall, there was a section near the top that had weakened, and so they took that down and replaced it with a new concrete structure. And they saved the bluestone that they removed and eventually put it back on. You know, I guess I didn't mention that you know the new dam. The spillway section no longer has the bluestone, so we don't have the issue anymore about popping stone off and losing the weight. So what we did do, though, is we dyed the concrete to a very similar color as to the old bluestone. And they used special forms which give like a rough appearance to the vertical portion of those steps, the risers. And it actually is pretty pleasing to look at. Here's a view of the two siphons that are there today. And we modified them a little bit. The old siphons actually just discharged right on top of the spillway channel, siphon floor. But that was going to get in the way of the reconstruction effort. So they buried the ends of those siphons into the actual spillway channel floor. When we decommission the siphons, once we have the low-level outlet constructed, this will be entombed in concrete. Right here, I'm looking from the west end, and I'm looking down on top of The spillway control section here are those press gates. There's the siphons. There's the new sectional floor. Here's a view looking down from the top of the plunge pool. And the steps that lead from the side channel floor. And here's a view of those, the ends of those siphons. Kind of gives you an idea how high up you are.
Can you just, though, explain how those crest gates work? I mean, other than what you said with the balloons, I mean, how do they open up sideways? Do they?
So if you could imagine, these steel panels are attached at the bottom on a hinge, like mm-hmm. a door. And so if you imagine the door standing vertical being on the floor, and the hinge being on the floor, and so as those bladders inflate, it pushes that door up.
Up or down?
As they inflate, the door goes up. The gate goes up. As you deflate these air bladders, the gate goes down.
So in other words, the purpose is to raise the door to hold more water in?
That's right. So I'll go over this in a little while, but what we found was that there is a good flood mitigation benefit to this notch. So in order to balance, the water supply and flood mitigation, we install these crest gates. So at certain times of the year, we have them up so that we can restore the reservoir to its full potential. At other times of the year, we leave them down, and so that provides a flood mitigation benefit. And I'll tell you when those movements occur. Here's a view near the plunge pool, looking upwards at the side channel floor, looking eastward. And here's a view from the east. One thing I didn't mention was that we also did some improvements to the embankment section of the dam. We added 100,000 cubic yards of stone to the upstream side of the embankment to try to flatten out the slope a little bit, which improved the stability of the earth and embankment section. And this is a barge I'm placing some of that stone. Those are the physical improvements. I want to spend a moment of talking about some of the other improvements that we did with respect to dam safety instrumentation. So we talked about those foundation under drains, and we measure the amount of water that's coming out of those drains. There were surface monuments. I don't know how many surveyors might be here or anybody that's familiar with surveying, but they installed monuments in the dam. The ones that were existing were, of course, destroyed during the reconstruction effort. They reinstalled the new monuments. The west training wall, we installed load cells so that we can measure how much the steel relaxes over time to make sure that the force that those post-tension anchors are providing is still providing a sufficient amount of force to meet the criteria that we've established. The one that's most exciting for me and for my staff is that almost all the instrumentation now is automated. Whereas before, you had to physically go out and go to an instrument and hook up some leads to it and collect some data and then go back and translate that data into some useful information. Now that is all done automatically at a much higher frequency than was done before. And so now it allows my dam safety engineer to spend more time analyzing the information retrieving it. This just gives you an idea of the amount of instrumentation in the earthen embankment section. I'm not going to bore you with the details of each one of these things, but the piezometers, those are basically measuring the water pressure in the earthen embankment, which is something that we want to track and make sure that over time that the trends are safely exhibiting safe parameters. And similarly, we've installed a lot of instrumentation in the concrete spillway. So recently, we received the Association of State Dam Safety Officials at the National Dam Dam Safety Conference this past September, the 2015 National Dam Rehabilitation Project of the Year.
Okay,
nice. All right. I was fortunate to be able to go down there and to New Orleans. That was my first time in New Orleans, and that's a neat city. I don't know if you've ever been there, but if you ever get a chance, I recommend it. We'll talk a little bit about how the dam helps out with flood mitigation. First, I just want to explain the concept of attenuation. So this is a graph here, and on this graph it's called a hydrograph, and this is just an imaginary hydrograph of water coming into a reservoir over time. So you've got the rate of flow is measured on the y-axis, and time is on the x-axis. And attenuation is when the peak flow is decreased. And the way that works for dams is that water goes into temporary storage. It's the same amount of water that ends up being spilled that otherwise would have come down the creek naturally if the dam wasn't there. But because the water goes into temporary storage, the peak of the curve, the same shape of the curve gets flattened, but it takes longer time to go out. So if the dam wasn't there, you'd have a spike, and then it would recede, but your peak flow would be much higher. With the dam present, the peak flow gets decreased, but it takes longer for all the water to come out. Now, this is just all the water that's above the spillway, above the elevation of the spillway. Here's a graph of what happened during Hurricane Irene, as pieced together by USGS in a report that they released a couple years ago. So this green graph is what was coming into the reservoir, and the purple is what left. And I've got here my notes, if you just want to know what those values were. It was about 137,000 cubic feet per second coming into the reservoir. And at its peak, about 111,000 cubic feet per second came out, or about a 19% reduction. So if the dam wasn't there, the flooding would have been 19% worse. Some of the other things that the dam provides, besides just itself attenuating flood flows, what have we done? We installed those crest gates, which provide an additional attenuation. And how that works is when those gates are open, in particular for the more frequent flood events, they allow more water to discharge early on the rising limb of the storm event. And so that helps to decrease that peak flow. The larger the storm events, the less that notch provides, the less that crest gate system provides. We also have a snowpack offset program. Basically, as the snowpack builds up over the course of the winter, we can pretty confidently rely on that 50% of the snow water equivalent of that snowpack will eventually come into the reservoir. So what we do is we create a void equal to the other 50%. And then we're going to build this future low-level outlet and have a release chamber. Its main purpose is for dam safety. That's how it's sized. It'll be able to provide up to 2,400 cubic feet per second release. But it can also provide a constant conservation release capability. And we submitted to the New York State DEC last December a feasibility study, which basically says, we think we can do it. We think we can provide a modest release. There's some complicating factors about Schoharie Reservoir. I don't know. Diane told you about the Shandaken Tunnel and how we divert water through the Shandaken Tunnel to the upper surface creek. We're regulated by the state on how much water we can provide and how turbid that water is. as well as the water temperature of that water. And so when we start releasing the water through the low-level outlet, it's going to be pulling some of that cold water from the reservoir storage. And so the people on the other side of the mountains, they don't like it, that there will be a Schoharie release capability, because they say, you're going to be taking our cold water. So we're working on, there's a world-class trout fishery over here on their side. That provides a lot of recreation and economic opportunity on that side. So, I get it. And so right now we're looking at some ways to see how can we mitigate, the loss of that cold water, so we can try to do both. So the snowpack offset program starts the 1st of November and April 30th of each year. As I mentioned, as the snow accumulates, we try to maintain a void in the reservoir. It comes 50% of the snow water equivalent through our normal diversion and also by passing water through the crest gates or through the siphons right now, eventually the low-level outlet. How do we measure that snow water equivalent? A number of means. We can measure it directly through a number of snow pillows that we have stationed throughout the watershed. And then they communicate back by radio telemetry. We also send field staff out to various sites to measure it and melt the water and figure out how much water is in there. And also National Weather Service models. And this is a map showing where these snow pillows are located in the watershed. Bringing it all together with respect to flood mitigation. So the dam itself provides a spill mitigation benefit. The smaller the storm event, the bigger the benefit. The larger the storm event, the less benefit it can provide. By keeping that crest notch, it provides an additional spill attenuation benefit. And the snowpack offset program further reduces storm events where you have like rain on snow melt events. So it provides a pretty good amount of protection across the year. This will be the year, January through December. This would be the over time, the average reservoir elevation. Normally in the winter, starting towards the end of the summer, and right now the crest gates are in the lower position, we lower the crest gates. And they stay lowered until some point in the spring, which time we will bring them back up so we can restore the reservoir and provide that water supply for the city. During that period, though, when we're providing that water supply for the city, we generally have the fewest large storm events. So these are the storm events that occur across the year. You can see that the largest storm events are occurring
March and April.
And this is actually the number of storm events and not the magnitude. So just to get that correct here. But most of our large storm events occur, in the winter when we've got the snowpack offset program providing that void. But also, when we get those tropical storm events and we have the crest gates lowered, and just through the normal use of the water supply reservoir, the reservoir is at a low state during the late summer, fall, early winter time period. So some actions moving forward. What do we have left to do? We're pretty much done with the extra dam reconstruction. We're just doing some punch list work now. We're starting now on the low-level outlet. The contractor is procuring labor, equipment, materials. Busy submitting his shop drawings for review. This is the project for the Shenanigan Tunnel intake chamber to rehabilitate that chamber. And then I mentioned that feasibility study now to take a look at how can we impact the mitigate the impacts of Schoharie Reef on the cold water storage. This is a diagram of the new low-level outlet. You have its intake at the bottom of the reservoir, go through a 9-foot diameter tunnel to a gate shaft. That gate shaft will be 181 feet deep. And then there will be a downstream leg of the 9-foot diameter tunnel, which will end in a valve chamber. We can isolate the downstream leg. There's gates inside this gate shaft that can isolate the downstream side of the tunnel, and we can also install bulkheads on the upstream side to isolate the upstream side in case we had to do work. There's also a Y at the end of this tunnel that's stubbed off in case hydropower ever becomes economically feasible at this site. Here's a diagram and an artist's rendition of the gate shaft. These are the two roller gates, right here, which isolate the gate shaft and the downstream tunnel from the upstream tunnel. And here's an artist's rendition of the new Harry release chamber. And the 9-foot diameter tunnel splits into two 78-inch lines. Each line has a capacity of 1,250 per second. And off of one of the lines is a 30-inch line, which will be able to provide that release, conservation release capability. And this has a backup generator that will provide power in case we lose utility power. And that finishes my portion of this discussion. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Yes.
Someone who likes to muck about in very small boats. It would be fun if there were more water in this area for you more often. And I'm wondering if that's been discussed, the recreational aspect of using the low-level outlets.
Well, it was brought up by the Schoharie County Board of Supervisors about recreational releases. Right now, we did not put that into our feasibility study. As you can imagine, if we were to do those large releases in the summer, that would greatly deplete the cold water. So that that could be very difficult to make that happen. It's up to the state. They're the ones that really have to balance and as well as can the water supply part with that water? Because when we do the recreational releases to the Esopus Creek, that water is staying in the water supply. It's going down to the Shokan Reservoir. If we do recreational releases to the Schoharie Creek, we're losing that water. So, that's a good question, but I can't tell you how it's going to go.
This means like a one-time big release for like white water.
That's right.
Okay, I was thinking of something a little more subtle and constant.
So that's something that we did do a study on, and we do believe that we can provide a modest year-round release, so that the creek doesn't, run dry in the summer like it does now. Yes, sir.
Can you explain what's meant by this training wall? I'm kind of confused by even the term. What are we training?
Yeah, it's an interesting term. It's a retaining wall. So it's holding back the earth just near the plunge pool. We call it training because it trains the flow of water to the Schoharie Creek on its way down. But it's a retaining wall. It's a giant retaining wall. Yes, ma'am.
What's the advantage of using bluestone in the beginning, and was that advantage completely lost because of the ice pushing them down?
Well, the bluestone was mined on site. So, it provided a hard surface. When the concrete was placed back in the early 20s, we have different admixtures that we provide to concrete nowadays, which gives it better resistance to weathering. Namely, we can put air bubbles into the concrete, and concrete has moisture in it, and it freezes, and those little ice crystals can chew up the concrete over time. And so that when you put air into the concrete, it provides a space for those ice crystals to expand into without without breaking up the aggregate and the cement that's holding that aggregate together. But that didn't exist back then. So, you know, they provided a stone weathering facade to try to provide that weatherproofing on the outside.
The Riverside Quarry was reopened in 2007, 2008, whatever it was. What did that stone get used for then?
So when we reopened that quarry, some people may know the term borrow pit. Mm-hmm. And most of the time when you borrow material from the borrow pit, you don't intend to put it back. But in this case, when we dismantled all the remaining bluestone and took off all the weak concrete on the surface, we put it back into that quarry.
So you opened it not to get new stone, but to return the old stone.
That's right. So if you look at it now, there's a big hill there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the back.
Yes, I'm just wondering what your data might show as regards to the gates and the release capabilities and really frigid temperatures during the winter as far as freezing goes.
So, is the question, you know, do the freezing temperatures affect our ability to raise and lower the crest gates?
The crest gates, and also you had the capabilities of releasing water. I don't know if it was just through that. Are there situations within that dam that freezing might be an issue, especially in wintertime when we might get a flood and the temperatures drop down quickly?
So, you know, water at the bottom of the reservoir stays, you know, pretty cold year-round, but it doesn't freeze at the bottom. And the intake for the neutral level outlet is at the bottom of the reservoir. So ice at the top, you know, won't affect our ability to release water through the low-level outlet. So far, we haven't had an issue with ice, our ability to operate the crest gates. But we don't intend to raise them up in the winter anyway. They're in the down position right now, and they'll remain that way until the spring.
Okay. What about the drain that comes into the spillway? Is that still? Is there anything that's underground that?
So the drains that go into the new gallery that runs through the length of the. Of the new spillway control section,
right?
That's protected by, you know, from the weather. It's inside, and it's basically the temperature of the earth. So it doesn't freeze. It's, you know, like 52 to 53 degrees down there. Yes, ma'am.
What's in the design to prevent the low-level outlet from getting silted up and becoming inoperable over time, like the old one?
Well, one of the things that will help prevent it is actually the conservation release, because we'll always be running water through it. The other thing is that, although I say it's on the bottom, it's not actually on the bottom. It's raised up off of the bottom. And we built screens around it so that the velocity of the water going into that intake is well below 1 foot per second. So it's not going to really carry a big sediment load that's going to cover it up. So we shouldn't have an issue with the new low-level outlet of it being covered up with sediment.
Just to follow up on what she said.
Okay.
If there are issues of maintenance, do you guys have a schedule or you're just constant supervision? I mean, what does that look like for us?
So, you know, we've gone through a number of improvements internally with our own workforce and scheduling maintenance. And So we have a system now of regular maintenance, and I keep track of it. And our goal is to complete 90% of all our scheduled maintenance every month. And actually, my division's been completing about 97% of its scheduled maintenance, which is good. It's really good.
During Irene, what was it that let go from the top of the dam and that created the rumor that the dam had broken?
Right. So, during construction, before all this concrete was, new concrete was here, and they were working on this end way down here. And to protect the workers, below the crest at that location, they built a small wooden wall, 3 foot tall. And I don't remember the length of the wall. It was, you know, it was designed to be able to hold up to 2 feet of water going over the top of it. So that would be 5 feet of water. If you recall, the January 96 flood was like 6.5 feet of water, which at that time was, you know, a monstrous flood event. We ended up getting close to 8 feet of water in Irene going over this building. 7.97. And so early in that storm event, as the wall, you know that graph that I showed you? Okay, so this graph here, see how vertical it is? Schoharie Reservoir is a small reservoir with a big watershed. And there's a very steep gradient from the headwaters to Schoharie Reservoir. So water gets to the reservoir very quickly. And it's flashy in nature. So you get this really quick rise of water, and very early on, that bulkhead failed, as it was designed to fail. It really, you know, we looked back at the USGS stream gauge records before the stream gauge got wiped out. Because these end up being estimates. If you look here, the curves look pretty smooth until they get up, you know, to like these areas here, and that's basically when the stream gauges got wiped out. But we didn't really see, you know, any, you know, blip of you know, big increase of flood that occurred, you know, when that wall failed. It really was just lost in the natural rising limb of that flood event. But that's, to answer your question, that's what occurred at the dam.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if this is a question or a comment, but I call up the dam site a lot whenever there's, you know, continuous days of rain. And I've been noticing that while those heavy days of rain are coming, that the graph shows that you've been lowering the water level, at least as, you know, while that rain is coming, so that should it really get to be big, we're already at a lower level. So is that a regular procedure now that you are lowering the dam when we might be having heavy rain events?
You know, we don't have we don't preemptively release water right now in advance of storm events. We have proposed a rule curve to operate the reservoir by in the future, which over most of the course of the year would try to keep the reservoir at a certain elevation to provide that storage void to help absorb some of those floodwaters. I think what you're seeing is really just the natural use of our diverting water from the reservoir through the Shenanigan Tunnel to DeSotis Creek. As I had mentioned previously, as you get into the summer and the fall, naturally, because of the use of a water supply reservoir, your storage decreases during that time of the year. A gentleman with a hat.
Question on the East End Observation Area. Is that ever going to be reopened?
Yes, sir, it will be. So that's part of the tunnel project. When they're done, they're going to build a new overlook on the East End so that people can go back up there.
Is that 2020?
2020 is when the contract is supposed to be done. I mean, right now he's put together a schedule that shows that he's trying to get done in 2019.
So how will you manage flow down to the Esopus while the Shenanigan Tunnel is being rehabbed?
Okay, so that's a great question. that would take an entire talk in itself because it's very complicated. Next question.
Will there be an operator on site if they lose communication to the control center in Gainesville?
In Grahamsville. And we do have an SOP now that someone, we're predicting a large storm event. I stationed an engineer up here to be able to make gate movements or valve movements in the future.
Excellent.
Yes, sir.
Hey, John, I was just wondering, with all the different anomalies that you have on there now and instrumentation to measure movement and so on and so forth, was there any kind of movement or did you see any kind of fluctuation that occurred back when that little 3.0 earthquake occurred?
Not at all.
Not at all.
No. No. But we did go out and inspect the dam as soon as we had daylight. And as part of our seismic SOP. So when those earthquakes occur, I get an automatic notification from the USGS, and so is my dam safety engineer. And so then we evaluate, we take a look at where did the earthquake occur, what was the magnitude, and how close is it to our dam. And then we decide whether or not we need to go out and inspect it or not. In that case, we did need to go inspect it, and we did. But we're going to enhance that SOP because we realize that we should provide feedback to you, through the emergency manager there for Schoharie County, when we're going to respond.
Homeland Security did try to contact OEM that evening also. So you can send us an email, but our director at that point hadn't received it until morning. But so Homeland Security did try to contact. So.
But we do intend to enhance our seismic SOP to make sure that we do that in the future. Yes, sir.
If you hadn't done all the MIST work, the dam would have given way during the Irene event.
So, I don't know how many people believe in God, but I do. I thank God that we went through the difficult times that we did in 2005 and 2006 to anchor the dam to the bedrock, because it's questionable.
The
perspective of here we are in October. It's actually 10 years ago this very month that the crisis was discovered at Gilboa Dam, and then that very month that we formed our Dam Concerned Citizens Group. And I just want to comment that we've come such a long way because we started out in a pretty adversarial relationship, and at that time the city of New York didn't want to use the M word at all, mitigation. And here we are 10 years later, and they're actually putting forward a reasonable plan for how we can balance the water supply needs with mitigation to take account of the impacts on the human beings who live in this valley. So we very much appreciate that and the improvements that have been made and the fact that we've been able to put ideas forth to the city and have some of them embraced in the course of the renovation. That's all been very positive. And I think, too, the fact that they've come in under budget and ahead of schedule on the improvements is very impressive. My question is really about the long-term. Somebody mentioned about maintenance, the long-term maintenance. And I don't doubt that all the professional engineers in the DEP will do all they can to make that happen. But are there requirements in the city budget process with the Municipal Finance Corporation or whatever that entity is that really require that they now have a long-term plan to make sure that there are resources in place for actual long-term maintenance? So this kind of crisis that evolved in 2005 could not happen again, because that would be a required process where the city has to have those funds in place for the whole reservoir system. Is there anything like that in the long-term city financial construct? That's kind of what I want to think.
Well, you know, there's no laws, there's no city laws that, you know, mandate, you know, setting aside funds for, you know, every, you know, project. It's really a responsibility. It's our stewardship, the leadership, and, you know, I'm very confident in the leadership that we have now, and we've done an enormous amount of capital reconstruction throughout the water supply system, and we continue to do so, and it's taken, you know, some political capital on the part of the mayor and the commissioner, because we've raised the water rates. All this gets paid for through the water rates, you know, the interest on the bonds and so forth. And so, you know, we've had to raise water rates every year. Now, it's still a good deal, you know, for New York City, for the 9 million plus people that rely on the water supply. But, my hat's off, you know, to, you know, the commissioner, DP commissioner, Commissioner Lloyd in particular, for having the foresight to fight for those dollars so that we can maintain. And it's really, it's for the health of the water supply too, right? So if my dam's going to fail, then my reservoir is not going to work. And you got to have your reservoir for the water supply. So, you know, I think that's the good news, right, is that water is a requirement. That in itself is the requirement. They need the water. And in order to supply the water, you have to have the infrastructure.
And are the water rates a dedicated revenue stream that has to go to that purpose in the water supply system?
Yeah, I don't know the exact percentage, but it's like 97 or 98% of our whole budget comes from the water rates.
What does the future possibilities look like with regards to control for flooding and stuff? Because I know someone had mentioned that before. Is there like a near future, or is there really no talk about that yet?
Okay, so this is the proposed rule curve that we've submitted to state, what we would do is we would try to do our diversion to the Esopus and on to Ashokan Reservoir and through the low-level outlet. We would try to keep the reservoir at an elevation at or below this line during the course of the year. And you'll notice that, you know, it provides a void in the reservoir over a lot of time of the year. At some point, though, we do have to restore the reservoir up to its full pool, so that we can use it for water supply. But if we have a rule curve, then we can, it's hard to, you know, 3 days in advance of a storm event, really make a meaningful void. Okay. Big reservoir, small pipes. I mean, 78-inch diameter pipes are not small, but compared to, you know, 19 billion gallon reservoir, they're small. So if you have a rule curve, you can make releases over time as you need to keep you at a target elevation. And when you have storm events, it's going to change, right? You'll have a storm and it'll go back up, and then you'll increase your releases, and you'll try to drive it back down, and those kinds of things. So it won't be it won't be an exact swim line. It'll be, you know, it'll kind of like that. That'll be the target. So that's what one of the ideas that we put together to address.
One last question on that. I know the Batavia Uphill Dam was one of the issues during that last storm. If they rebuild it and put it back up, will that be considered in this plan?
DEP does not own the Batavia Uphill Dam, so we really have nothing to do with that.
Well, what I'm saying is, as far as with regards to where you want to keep the water, especially during certain times of the year, if they do put that, that's water that flows into that reservoir, that's quite a bit of water.
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
Thank you, John. This has been a wonderful juxtaposition between the original construction of the dam and your program and the rehab. On behalf of the DCC, the directors and members, we would like to give you a present. We know we can't give you something of monetary value, and I assure you this isn't of no monetary value. These are trout flies I tied. It says on there, John 21:3 in a card in the Bible, John says to Christ, I go fishing. The pastor's here, so I'm next week's program will be Mark Cornwell and the students at SUNY Cole still dealing with the ecology of the Schoharie Creek and three different ecosystems based on where you are in the system in terms of elevation, how far north you're going in the system, where we flow north. So the further north, the lower you are down. Thank you all very much for coming. Thank you.